This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Scrum, The Art of Doing Twice the Work in Half the Time by Jeff Sutherland. Read for you by J.J. Sutherland. Preface. Why Scrum? I first created Scrum with Ken Schwaber 20 years ago as a faster, more reliable, more effective way to create software in the tech industry. Up to that point, and even as late as 2005, most software development projects were created using the waterfall method, where a project was completed in distinct stages and moved step by step toward ultimate release to consumers or software users. The process was slow, unpredictable, and often never resulted in a product that people wanted or would pay to buy. Delays of months or even years were endemic to the process. The early step-by-step plans laid out in comforting detail in Gantt charts reassured management that we were in control of the development process, but almost without fail, we would quickly fall behind schedule and disastrously over budget. To overcome those faults, in 1993, I invented a new way of doing things, Scrum. It is a radical change from the prescriptive, top-down project management methodologies of the past. Scrum, instead, is akin to evolutionary, adaptive, and self-correcting systems. Since its inception, the Scrum framework has become the way the tech industry creates new software and products. But while Scrum has become famously successful in managing software and hardware projects in Silicon Valley, it remains relatively unknown in general business practice. And that is why I wrote Scrum, to reveal and explain the Scrum management system to businesses outside the world of technology. In the book, I talk about the origins of Scrum in the Toyota production system and the OODA loop of combat aviation. I discuss how we organize projects around small teams and why that is such an effective way to work. I explain how we prioritize projects, how we set up 1 week to 1 month sprints to gain momentum and hold everyone on the team accountable, how we conduct brief daily stand-ups to keep tabs on what has been done and on the challenges that have inevitably cropped up, and how Scrum incorporates the concepts of continuous improvement and minimum viable products to get immediate feedback from consumers rather than waiting until a project is finished. As you'll hear, we've used Scrum to build everything from affordable 100-mile-per-gallon cars to bringing the FBI database systems into the 21st century. Keep listening. I think you'll hear how Scrum can help transform how your company works, creates, plans, and thinks. I firmly believe that Scrum can help to revolutionize how business works in virtually every industry. Just as it has revolutionized innovation and speed to market at a dazzling array of new companies and a breathtaking range of new products emerging out of Silicon Valley and the world of technology. Jeff Sutherland, PhD. Chapter 1. The way the world works is broken. Jeff Johnson was pretty sure it wasn't going to be a good day. On March 3, 2010, the Federal Bureau of Investigation killed its biggest and most ambitious modernization project. The one that was supposed to prevent another 9/11, but that had devolved into one of the biggest software debacles of all time. For more than a decade, the FBI had been trying to update its computer system, and it looked as if they would fail again. And now it was his baby. He'd shown up at the FBI 7 months earlier, lured there by the new chief information officer, Chad Fulham, whom he'd worked with at Lehman Brothers. Jeff was assistant director of the IT engineering division. He had an office on the top floor of the J. Edgar Hoover building in downtown Washington, D.C. It was a big office. It even had a view of the Washington Monument. Little did Jeff know, he'd end up in a windowless cinder block office in the basement for much of the next 2 years, trying to fix something that everyone believed to be unfixable. It was not an easy decision, Jeff says. He and his boss had decided to declare defeat and kill a program that had already taken nearly a decade and cost hundreds of millions of dollars. By that point, it made more sense to bring the project in-house and do it themselves. But it needed to be done, and done well. The project was the long-awaited computer system that would bring the FBI into the modern age. In 2010, the era of Facebook, Twitter, Amazon, and Google, the FBI was still filing most of its reports on paper. The system the Bureau used was called the Automated Case Support System. It ran on gigantic mainframe computers that had been state-of-the-art sometime in the 80s. Many special agents didn't even use it. It was just too cumbersome and too slow in an era of terror attacks and swift-moving criminals. When an FBI agent wanted to do something, anything really, from paying an informant to pursuing a terrorist to filing a report on a bank robber, the process wasn't that different from what it had been 30 years earlier. Johnson describes it this way. You would write up a document in a word processor and print out three copies. One would be sent up the approval chain. One would be stored locally in case that one got lost. And with the third, you'd take a red pen. I'm not kidding. A red pen. And circle the keywords for input into the database. You'd index your own report. When a request was approved, that paper copy would drift down from upstairs with a number on it. A number written on a piece of paper is how the FBI kept track of all its case files. This method was so antiquated and porous that it was blamed in part for the Bureau's failure to connect the dots that showed various Al-Qaeda activists entering the country in the weeks and months before 9/11. One office was suspicious of one person. Another wondered why so many suspicious foreigners were getting flight training. Another had someone on a watch list but never told anyone else. No one in the Bureau ever put it all together. The 9/11 Commission drilled down after the attack and tried to discover the core reason it was allowed to happen. Analysts, said the Commission, couldn't get access to the very information they were supposed to analyze. The poor state of the FBI's information systems, reads the report, meant that such access depended in large part on an analyst's personal relationships with individuals in the operational units or squads where the information resided. Before 9/11, the FBI had never completed an assessment of the overall terrorism threat to the United States. There were a lot of reasons for this, from focus on career advancement to lack of information sharing, but the report singled out lack of technological sophistication as perhaps the key reason the Bureau failed so dramatically in the days leading up to 9/11. The FBI's information systems were woefully inadequate, the Commission's report concludes. The FBI lacked the ability to know what it knew. There was no effective mechanism for capturing or sharing its institutional knowledge. When senators started asking the Bureau some uncomfortable questions, the FBI basically said, "Don't worry, we have a modernization plan already in the works." The plan was called the Virtual Case File System, VCF, and it was supposed to change everything. Not letting any crisis go to waste, officials said they only needed another $70 million on top of the $100 million already budgeted for the plan. If you go back and read press reports on VCF at the time, you'll notice that the words revolutionary and transformation are used liberally. 3 years later, the program was killed. It didn't work. Not even a little bit. The FBI had spent $170 million in taxpayer money to buy a computer system that would never be used. Not a single line of code or application or mouse click. The whole thing was an unmitigated disaster. And this wasn't simply IBM or Microsoft making a mistake. People's lives were quite literally on the line. As Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, then the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, told the Washington Post at the time, "We had information that could have stopped 9/11. It was sitting there and was not acted upon. I haven't seen them correct the problems. We might be in the 22nd century before we get the 21st century technology." It is rather telling that many of the people who were at the FBI when the virtual case file disaster happened aren't there anymore. In 2005, the FBI announced a new program, Sentinel. This time it would work. This time they put in the right safeguards, the right budget procedures, the right controls. They'd learn their lesson. The price tag? A mere $451 million. And it would be fully operational by 2009. What could possibly go wrong? In March of 2010, the answer landed on Jeff Johnson's desk. Lockheed Martin, the contractor hired to make the Sentinel system, had already spent $405 million. They developed only half of the project, and it was already a year late. An independent analysis estimated that it would take another 6 to 8 years to finish the project, and the taxpayers would have to throw in at least another $350 million. Finding some way around that was Johnson's problem. What went wrong and how the situation got fixed are why I'm writing this book. It wasn't that these weren't smart people. It wasn't that the Bureau didn't have the right personnel in place or even the right technology. It wasn't about a work ethic or the right supply of competitive juices. It was because of the way people were working, the way most people work, the way we think work has to be done, because that's the way we were taught to do it. When you hear what happened, it sounds at first as if it makes sense. The people at Lockheed sat down before they bid on the contract, looked at the requirements, and started planning how to build a system that would do all that. They had lots of intelligent people working for months, figuring out what needed to be done. Then they spent more months planning how to do it. They produced beautiful charts with everything that needed to be accomplished and the time it would take to complete each and every task. Then, with careful color selection, they showed each piece of the project cascading down to the next like a waterfall. These charts are called Gantt charts, after Henry Gantt, who developed them. With the advent of personal computers in the 1980s making it easy to create these intricate charts and to make them really complex, they have become works of art. Every single step in a project is laid out in detail. Every milestone, every delivery date, these charts are impressive to behold. The only problem with them is that they are always, always wrong. Henry Gantt invented his famous charts around 1910. They were first used in World War I by General William Crozier, who was the chief of ordnance for the U.S. Army. Anyone who has studied that war knows that efficient organizational capability was not exactly a salient feature. Why a World War I artifact has become the de facto tool used in 21st century project management has never been quite clear to me. We gave up on trench warfare, but somehow the ideas that organized it are still popular. It's just so tempting. All the work needed to be done on a massive project laid out for everyone to see. I visited many companies that have people whose only job is to update that Gantt chart every day. The trouble is, once that beautifully elegant plan meets reality, it falls apart. But instead of scrapping the plan, or the way they think about the plan, managers instead hire people to make it look as if the plan is working. Essentially, they're paying people to lie to them. This unfortunate pattern echoes those reports the Soviet Politburo was getting in the 1980s, just before the total collapse of the USSR. A complete mirage. Now, as then, the reports become more important than the reality they're supposed to describe. And if there's a discrepancy, reality is the problem, not the charts. When I was a West Point cadet, I slept in Dwight Eisenhower's old room. At night, the streetlights would reflect off a gold plate on the mantelpiece and sometimes wake me up. "Dwight D. Eisenhower slept here," the plate read. And I'd remember that Eisenhower once observed that planning for combat is important, but as soon as the first shot is fired, your plans go up in smoke. At least he had enough sense not to use a Gantt chart. So Lockheed presented the FBI with all of these lovely charts, and the Bureau signed on. Supposedly, the task was now so well planned out that nothing could go wrong. Look, it's in the color-coded timestamp bar graph plan. Yet, when Jeff and his boss, CIO Chief Chad Fulham, looked at the plan in the spring of 2010, they knew it for what it was, what such charts all are, really, a complete fabrication. When the two men started to look at actual development and actual deliverables, they realized the problem was beyond fixing. New defects in the software were being discovered faster than old ones were being fixed. Chad told the Department of Justice Inspector General that they could complete the Sentinel project by bringing development in-house, cutting the number of developers, and that, by doing so, they deliver the most challenging half of the project in less than a fifth of the time with less than a tenth of the amount budgeted. The skepticism in the usually dry IG reports to Congress is palpable. In the October 2010 report, after laying out their 9 points of concern with the proposal, the IG watchdogs conclude, "In sum, we have significant concerns and questions about the ability of this new approach to complete the Sentinel project within budget in a timely fashion and with similar functionality. A new way of thinking. This new approach is called Scrum. I created it 20 years ago. Now, it is the only way proven to help projects like these. There are two ways of doing things. The old waterfall method that wastes hundreds of millions of dollars and often doesn't deliver anything, or the new way, which, with fewer people and in less time, can deliver more stuff with higher quality at lower cost. I know it sounds too good to be true, but the proof is in the results. It works. 2 decades ago, I was desperate. I needed a new way of thinking about work. And through tons of research and experimentation and looking over past data, I realized we all needed a new way of organizing human endeavor. None of it is rocket science. It's all been talked about before. There are studies going back to World War II that lay out some of the better ways that people work. But for some reason, people never really put together all the pieces. Over the past 2 decades, I've tried to do just that. And now, this methodology has become ubiquitous in the first field I applied it to, software development. At giants such as Google, Amazon, and Salesforce.com, and at small startups you haven't heard of yet, this framework has radically shifted how people get things done. The reason this framework works is simple. I looked at how people actually work, rather than how they say they work. I looked at research done over decades and at best practices in companies all over the world, and I looked deeply at the best teams within those companies. What made them superior? What made them different? Why do some teams achieve greatness and others mediocrity? For reasons I'll get into further in future chapters, I called this framework for team performance Scrum. The term comes from the game of rugby, and it refers to the way a team works together to move the ball down the field. Careful alignment, unity of purpose, and clarity of goal come together. It's the perfect metaphor for what I want teams to do. Traditionally, management wants two things on any project: control and predictability. This leads to vast numbers of documents and graphs and charts, just like at Lockheed. Months of effort go into planning every detail so there will be no mistakes, no cost overruns, and things will be delivered on schedule. The problem is that the rosy scenario never actually unfolds. All that effort poured into planning, trying to restrict change, trying to know the unknowable, is wasted. Every project involves discovery of problems and bursts of inspiration. Trying to restrict a human endeavor of any scope color-coded charts and graphs is foolish and doomed to failure. It's not how people work, and it's not how projects progress. It's not how ideas reach fruition or how great things are made. Instead, it leads to frustrated people not getting what they want. Projects are delayed, come in over budget, and in too many cases end in abject failure. This is especially true for teams involved in the creative work of crafting something new. Most of the time, management won't learn of the glide path toward failure until millions of dollars and thousands of hours have been invested for naught. Scrum asks why it takes so long and so much effort to do stuff, and why we're so bad at figuring out how long and how much effort things will take. The cathedral at Chartres took 57 years to build. It's a safe bet that at the beginning of the project, the stonemasons looked at the bishop and said, 20 years, max, probably be done in 15. Scrum embraces uncertainty and creativity. It places a structure around the learning process, enabling teams to assess both what they've created and, just as important, how they created it. The Scrum framework harnesses how teams actually work and gives them the tools to self-organize and rapidly improve both speed and quality of work. At its root, Scrum is based on a simple idea. Whenever you start a project, why not regularly check in, see if what you're doing is heading in the right direction, and if it's actually what people want? And question whether there are any ways to improve how you're doing what you're doing, any ways of doing it better and faster, and what might be keeping you from doing that. That's what's called an inspect and adapt cycle. Every little while, stop what you're doing, review what you've done, and see if it's still what you should be doing and how you might do it better. It's a simple idea, but executing it requires thought, introspection, honesty, and discipline. I'm writing this book to show you how to do it, and not just in software companies. I've seen Scrum used successfully to build cars, run a laundry, teach students in a classroom, make rocket ships, plan a wedding, even as my wife has used it to make sure that the honey-do list gets done every weekend. The end results of Scrum, the design goal, if you will, are teams that dramatically improve the productivity. Over the past 20 years, I've built those teams over and over and over again. I've been the CEO, CTO, or head of engineering of a dozen companies, from small startups with a few people in one room to large enterprises with offices spread across the planet. I've consulted and coached hundreds more. The results can be so dramatic that leading research and analysis firms, such as Gartner, Forrester Research, and the Standish Group, now say that the old style of work is obsolete. Companies that still cling to tried but not true ideas of command and control and that attempt to impose rigid predictability are simply doomed to fail if their competitors use Scrum. The difference is too great. Venture capital firms like OpenView Venture Partners in Boston, where I'm an advisor, say that Scrum offers too big a competitive advantage not to use it. These are not warm and fuzzy people. These are gimlet-eyed money men. And they simply say, the results are indisputable. Companies have two choices, change or die. Fixing the FBI. At the FBI, the first problem the Sentinel team faced was contracts. Every single change ended up being a contract negotiation with Lockheed Martin. So Jeff Johnson and Chad Fulham spent months unraveling all the contracts, taking the development inside and cutting the staff from hundreds to under 50. The core team was even smaller. The first week, they did what a lot of people in these circumstances do. They printed out all the requirements documentation. If you've never seen what that looks like on a large project, it can be hundreds and hundreds of pages. I've seen stacks that are several feet high. I've seen this in project after project. People cut and paste and throw in boilerplate, but no one actually reads all those thousands of pages. They can't. That's the point. They've set up a system that forces them to endorse a fantasy. There were 1,100 requirements. The stack was a few inches thick, says Johnson. Just thinking about those documents makes me feel for the people who had probably spent weeks of their lives producing those documents that had no purpose. The FBI and Lockheed Martin aren't alone in this. I've seen this duplicated at almost every company I have worked with. That tall stack of futility is one of the reasons Scrum can be such a powerful change for people. No one should spend their lives on meaningless work. Not only is it not good business, it kills the soul. So after they had the stack, they went through and prioritized each requirement, which is vitally important and trickier than it sounds. Often people simply say that everything is important. But what they need to ask, what the Sentinel teams asked, was, what will bring the most value to the project? Do those things first. In software development, there is a rule, borne out by decades of research, that 80% of the value in any piece of software is in 20% of the features. Think about it. When was the last time you used the Visual Basic Editor function in Microsoft Word? You probably don't know what Visual Basic is, let alone why you'd use it. But it's there, and someone spent time implementing it. But I guarantee you, it doesn't increase the value of Word by much. Making people prioritize by value forces them to produce that 20% first. Often by the time they're done, they realize they don't really need the other 80%, or what seemed important at the outset actually isn't. For the Sentinel team, the question became, okay, we're doing this huge project that is vitally important that we've wasted hundreds of millions of dollars on. When will it be done? After thinking on it, they promised delivery in the fall of 2011. The Inspector General report from the fall of 2010 is a study in disbelief. The FBI stated that it will employ an agile methodology to complete the development of Sentinel using fewer employees from the FBI, Lockheed Martin, and the companies that have supplied the major off-the-shelf components of Sentinel. Overall, the FBI plans to reduce the number of contract employees working on Sentinel from approximately 220 to 40. The FBI said that, at the same time, the number of FBI employees assigned to the project will also decrease from 30 to 12. The FBI told us it believes it can complete Sentinel with the approximately $20 million remaining in the Sentinel budget and within 12 months of beginning this new approach. The use of the phrase agile methodology shows just how little the IG knew about Scrum. The term agile dates back to a 2001 conclave where I and 16 other leaders in software development wrote up what has become known as the Agile Manifesto. It declared the following values: people over processes, products that actually work over documenting what that product is supposed to do, collaborating with customers over negotiating with them, and responding to change over following a plan. Scrum is the framework I built to put those values into practice. There is no methodology. Of course, Johnson's 12-month promise was somewhat misleading because, in actuality, they didn't know. They couldn't know. The FBI didn't know how fast their teams could actually work. It's something I tell executives all the time. I'll know what the date will be when I see how much the teams improve, how fast they'll get, how much they'll accelerate. It was also crucial, of course, that team members figure out what would stop them from accelerating. As Jeff Johnson put it, I handled impediment removal. An impediment is an idea that comes from the company that first formed a lot of the ideas Scrum is based on, Toyota, and more specifically, Daiichi Ono's Toyota Production System. I won't go into all the details here, but one of the key concepts that Ono introduced is the idea of flow. That is, production should flow swiftly and calmly throughout the process. And, he said, one of management's key tasks is to identify and remove impediments to that flow. Everything that stands in the way is waste. Ono gives waste a moral as well as a business value in his classic book, The Toyota Production System. It is not an exaggeration that in a low-growth period, such waste is a crime against society more than a business loss. Eliminating waste must be a business's first objective. Ono talks a lot about the different kinds of waste and impediments that can get in the way of production. For Scrum to really take off, someone in senior management needs to understand in his bones that impediments are nearly criminal. I'll tell you how to eliminate waste later on in the book. Suffice it to say here that the effect of eliminating waste is dramatic, but people often don't do it because it requires being honest with themselves and with others. Jeff Johnson knew that was his job. It took the Sentinel team about 3 months to figure out how long completing the project would really take. Why? This goes back to that inspect and adapt cycle I talked about earlier. Scrum works by setting sequential goals that must be completed in a fixed length of time. In the FBI's case, they decided on 2-week cycles, with the understanding that at the end of each cycle, there would be a finished increment of product. That meant they'd have something working, something that could be shown to anyone who cared to look, but certainly the stakeholders, and optimally, the people who'd actually be using the thing. This methodology allows teams to get near real-time feedback on their work. Are they headed in the right direction? Is what they're planning to do next really what they should be doing, given what they've discovered during that cycle? In Scrum, we call these cycles sprints. At the beginning of each cycle, there is a meeting to plan the sprint. The team decides how much work they think they can accomplish during the next 2 weeks. They'll take the work items off that prioritized list of things that need to be done and often just write them out on sticky notes and put them on a wall. The team decides how many of those work items they can get done during this sprint. At the end of the sprint, the team comes together and shows what they've accomplished during the time they've collaborated. They look at how many of those sticky notes they actually got done. Did they bring too many into the sprint and not finish them all? Did they not bring enough? What's important here is that they begin to have a baseline sense of how fast they can go, their velocity. After they've shown what they've done, and here's where Ono's ideas come in, they discuss not what they did, but how they did it. They ask, how can we work together better in the next sprint? What was getting in our way during the last one? What are the impediments that are slowing our velocity? You will hear a more detailed explanation of how Scrum works in the appendix. And that's why Jeff Johnson needed a few months before he could really tell how long the project would take. He wanted to measure the velocity of each team, measured over a few sprints, and then see how much they could improve, how much faster they could go. Once he looked at how many work items each team had finished in each sprint, and then checked how many they had remaining until the end of the project, he could forecast a completion date. Besides learning how fast the teams were going, he also wanted to know what impediments were slowing them down. What he really wanted to do was accelerate those teams so they were producing faster. Not by working longer hours. I'll go into why that's a fruitless rat hole that ends up making things take longer later. But by working better and smarter. Jeff Johnson says his teams increased their productivity by a factor of 3. They were going 3 times as fast once they got moving as compared to when they started. Why? They got better at working together, yes. But most important, they figured out the things that were slowing them down. And each cycle, each sprint, they'd try to get rid of them. It eventually took the Sentinel project 18 months of coding to get the database system deployed, and another 2 months to deploy it to the entire FBI. Tremendous time pressure, Johnson said when he sat down for an interview. And you have to understand, the system is used for everything. Paying informants, storing evidence, case files, calendars. This meeting is in Sentinel. And the most powerful part of Scrum from his point of view? Demos. Driving toward a demonstrable product on a frequent basis. Every 2 weeks, the Sentinel team would demonstrate what they'd accomplished. And the show and tell wasn't just to themselves. They were taking what they'd achieved and running it by the people who would actually be using the system. Everyone who had a stake in the project sent someone, and that could make for a pretty full house. Records, intelligence, special agents, the Office of the Inspector General, representatives from other government agencies. Often enough, the director and deputy director of the FBI were in the room, as was the acting inspector general herself. This was not an easy crowd. And that was what made it work, says Johnson. Scrum is not about the developers. It's about the customers and stakeholders. Really, it was an organizational change. Showing the actual product was the most powerful part. Actually showing the product was powerful because people were, to put it mildly, skeptical of the team's reported progress. They just couldn't believe Sentinel's progress actually kept moving at a faster and faster rate. I was saying to Congress that with 5% of the budget and in 20 months, we are going to accomplish what Lockheed couldn't do with 90% of the budget in 10 years, says Johnson. There was skepticism in the room. We had to provide reports to the Associate Attorney General. We would be transparent with our status, but our audience would assume something devious was going on. Anytime they'd seen those kinds of indicators in the past, the reports were less detailed and something else was going on. And that skepticism infected the rest of the FBI.
The guys down in the basement are just going to screw it up again, was the thinking.
This will be just one more temporary system that will fail and will have to go back to using paper. Jeff told his team about a passage he had to memorize when he was a naval cadet at Annapolis. It was from Teddy Roosevelt's speech, Citizenship in a Republic, which he gave at the Sorbonne in 1910. It is oft quoted, and you may already be familiar with it. It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, who comes short again and again, because there's no effort without error and shortcoming. But who does actually strive to do the deeds? Who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who, at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat. The team did have some delays as they figured out exactly how fast they could do things, and just how hard things were to do. Finally, in July of 2012, they turned Sentinel on. And they had to turn it on all the way, to everybody, all at once. There was no way to stage it. It happened from one day to the next, in a criminal case or counterterrorism case. Something in Los Angeles might be related to something in Chicago, says Jeff Johnson. We couldn't allow leads to be lost. At every point, we had to have a clean and known good state. And that state had to be clean and good enough to hold up in court. The data in Sentinel was being used to prosecute people, and its integrity had to be beyond a shadow of doubt. Jeff was frantic and nervous that first day. He went into his office and turned on Sentinel. It loaded. That was a good thing. And then he tried to approve a document with an electronic signature, a basic everyday task that tens of thousands of FBI employees would have to do all the time. Up came an error message. It didn't work. He started to panic, Johnson remembers, visions of disaster dancing in his head. And then he looked carefully at the error code and realized what it meant. He hadn't inserted his ID card into the machine to verify his identity. He put in the card, clicked his mouse, and Sentinel was good to go. The effect of Sentinel on the FBI has been dramatic. The ability to communicate and share information has fundamentally changed what the Bureau is capable of. In January of 2013, an FBI field office was called in when a small business account was hacked. $1 million was transferred to another country before U.S. banks could stop it. Using Sentinel, the local office coordinated with a legal attaché in the destination country's embassy, who then alerted local law enforcement authorities, who, in turn, stopped the transfer before it hit the banking system. This all happened in a matter of hours, something that simply couldn't have been done in the days of three paper copies and red pens. It was the difference between catching a crook and letting him get away with it. In the basement of the FBI, the Sentinel team is still there, the panels removed from their cubicles so they can see one another. There's a poster-sized copy of the Agile Principles on the wall, principles I helped write and have devoted my life to implementing around the world. Amazingly enough for a room without windows, a healthy lavender plant thrives under fluorescent lights as you enter the room. Lavender was the codename of the Sentinel prototype. The team members are still at their posts, making improvements and adding new functionality to the system they built. There's an old joke in the Scrum community. A chicken and a pig are walking down the road, and the chicken says, "Hey, pig, I was thinking we should open up a restaurant." "What should we call it?" asks the pig. "How about ham and eggs?" "No thanks," says the pig. "I'd be committed, but you'd only be involved." The idea in Scrum is that the pigs are the ones who are totally committed to the project and are responsible for its outcome. The chickens are the people who are informed of its progress, the stakeholders. On the wall in the Sentinel room is a pig-shaped bell. When it rings, the people who did what everyone said couldn't be done know they're being called. There's another bell, the doorbell, but that's for the chickens. The world is constantly getting more complicated, and the work we do is gaining in complexity at an ever-increasing rate. Take cars, for example. I used to work on my car all the time, doing basic repairs. 30 years ago, I could rebuild a radiator. Now, when I pop open the hood, I may as well be looking at the insides of a computer. Actually, that's basically what I am doing, since a new Ford has more lines of code in it than Facebook and Twitter combined. Creating something that complex is a massive human endeavor. Whenever people are involved in a complex, creative effort, whether they're trying to send a rocket to space, build a better light switch, or capture a criminal, traditional management methods simply break apart. And we know this as individuals and as a society. We see echoes of our real lives captured in fictional workplace dystopias, like those depicted in the cartoon Dilbert or the movie Office Space. We've all gone home and told our partners or friends of the madness that is the modern corporate organization. We've all been told that filling out the form correctly is more important than doing the work, or that we need to have a meeting to prep for the pre-meeting meeting. It's madness, and yet we keep on doing it, even in the face of absolute and complete failure. The launch of healthcare.gov, the website where Americans are supposed to be able to sign up for health insurance, is a great example. The front end was beautiful. It was clever, clear, a great design. It was completed in 3 months using Scrum. The back end, though, that was the debacle. It simply didn't work. It was supposed to hook up databases in the IRS to state databases, to insurance company databases, to the Department of Health and Human Services. This is a complex piece of work. It involved more than 20 contractors working on different bits and pieces, and they planned it all using waterfall techniques. They only tested the site at the very end for a few days, rather than doing incremental testing along the way. The tragedy is that everyone knew better. The people who work for those contractors aren't stupid. They knew better. The problem was, everyone said, "Not my job." They delivered their piece and left it at that. They never looked at the site from the user's point of view, merely from their own. The reason they could do that was that they weren't aligned, weren't united in a common purpose. What Scrum does is bring teams together to create great things. And that requires everyone not only to see the end goal, but to deliver incrementally toward that goal. There was no one in charge of the healthcare.gov project who insisted everything be tested as it was built. And unfortunately, as failures go, the site is hardly atypical. The people who fixed healthcare.gov, they used Scrum. How many times do you hear about some massive project costing millions and millions being canceled, not only because of the cost overruns, but because it simply doesn't work? How many billions of dollars are spent each year producing nothing? How much of your life is wasted on work that both you and your boss realize doesn't create value? You might as well be digging holes and filling them in again for all the impact you're having. It doesn't have to be this way. It really doesn't. Just because everyone has always told you that's the way the world works doesn't mean they're right. There is a different way of doing things, a different way of working. And if you don't do it, you'll be outsourced. Or your company will die. The hyper-competitive world of 21st century work has no room for waste and foolishness. A further important point. Working in a maximally productive way, the Scrum way, doesn't have to be confined to business. What if people use this method to address the big problems our species struggles with, such as dependence on oil, or poor education, or lack of clean water in impoverished areas of the globe, or rampant crime? What if there really was a better way to live and work and solve problems differently? A way we really could change the world. There is. There are people using Scrum to address each of those problems I've mentioned, and they're making a powerful impact. In this book, you're going to learn some of the fundamental ways that people work best, why we're awful at estimating, and why working overtime will make your project late. I'm going to take you through all the research and applications that people and scientists and organizations have diligently done for years, and how Scrum ties it all together in a way that you can implement tomorrow. I'm going to show you how. First, though, I want to tell the story of how I got here. The takeaway. Planning is useful. Blindly following plans is stupid. It's just so tempting to draw up endless charts. All the work needed to be done on a massive project laid out for everyone to see. But when detailed plans meet reality, they fall apart. Build into your working method the assumption of change, discovery, and new ideas. Inspect and adapt. Every little while, stop doing what you're doing, review what you've done, and see if it's still what you should be doing and if you can do it better. Change or die. Clinging to the old way of doing things, of command and control and rigid predictability, will only bring failure. In the meantime, the competition that is willing to change will leave you in the dust. Fail fast so you can fix early. Corporate culture often puts more weight on forms, procedures, and meetings than on visible value creation that can be inspected at short intervals by users. Work that does not produce real value is madness. Working product in short cycles allows early user feedback, and you can immediately eliminate what is obviously wasteful effort. Chapter 2. The Origins of Scrum. For American fighter pilots in Vietnam, a tour of duty meant flying 100 missions into enemy territory. 50% of the pilots got shot down. Some were rescued, but most never made it back. In 1967, as a young, somewhat wet behind the ears fighter pilot, I was shipped from Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho to Udorn Royal Thai Air Force Base in northern Thailand to do what was the most dangerous job in the U.S. Air Force, reconnaissance. This was long before the age of Predator drone missions and reliable satellite imagery. My RF-4C Phantom was stripped of all weapons and equipped with cameras and an extra fuel tank. My job was to fly into enemy territory so that my navigator could take before and after photos of our bombing missions. Most of the missions were at night, and I'd race through the tropical darkness just a few hundred feet from the ground, almost brushing the treetops. The moment I crossed over the border into North Vietnam, my heads-up display would light up like a pinball machine, and the loud missile warning system would go off with a flurry of beeps and whistles. The sky would brighten with tracer fire from anti-aircraft guns, and I knew that, in minutes, missile radar would soon be pinpointing my aircraft, unless 500 feet was low enough to stay in the ground clutter. During those moments, my adrenaline would pump, but I never lost my cool. Instead, the danger almost settled me. I credit this to the training I got from the Air Force on how to control risk. That training taught me to do four things: observe, orient, decide, and act. Specifically, I would observe the target area, figure out the best path into the hot zone and the best path out, orient myself in the face of unexpected events, then act decisively based on instincts and hardwiring. Hesitation could get pilots killed, but so did foolhardiness. As soon as my navigator had taken his pictures, I'd yank back on the stick and pull up out of the hot zone, the G-force reducing my vision to a pinprick. My navigator often passed out from the G-force, or, in some cases, lost control of his bowels. But he never complained, because I always got us back alive. Back then, I was just a young jet pilot hoping to survive my required missions. I didn't know that my flight experience and the training I'd received on how to think and act in a life-or-death situation would shape the way I would work for the rest of my life. I arrived in Vietnam in 1967 with squadrons of F-4 fighters and RF-4C reconnaissance aircraft, 100 planes in total. The aircraft replaced two squadrons of RF-101s. Of those 50 RF-101s, all but four had been shot down in 1 year. The four remaining had so many bullet holes, they were unflyable. I'm not sure how their pilots landed them after their last mission. The RF-4C was a more resilient fighter plane, but half of our aircraft were still shot down within a year. We'd improved survivability, but still, 50% of those who showed up with me didn't make it back to base. The lucky ones were rescued from the jungle before they could be imprisoned. When I returned from the Vietnam War, I pursued a master's degree from Stanford in statistics and spent as much time as possible at the Stanford Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. From there, I became a professor of mathematics at the Air Force Academy, where I embarked on a PhD program in biometrics at the University of Colorado Medical School. There I asked my advisor, Dr. John Baylar, one of the most distinguished researchers in medicine and statistics, how I could do a thesis that would be useful and not wind up on a dusty shelf in the library. He handed me 300 medical journal papers on cancer. Each had graphs showing cancer statistics, which varied wildly for humans and animals and tumor types. Baylar said that if I could explain why they were all different, he'd award me a doctoral degree. So that's what I did, and I got that degree. How I did it was by spending years trying to figure out what happens in a cell to turn it cancerous. I learned a lot about systems theory and how a system only has certain stable states. As a cell evolves, it moves from one stable state to another. Figuring out the rules to move a complex adaptive system from one state to another and how to make the next state a positive one rather than a negative one was something I spent nearly a decade on. Years later, it occurred to me that organizations, teams, and people are all complex adaptive systems. The same things that move cells from one state to another are also what move people from one state to another. To change a cell, you first inject energy into the system. At first, there's chaos. There seem to be no rules. Everything is in flux. When you do this to organizations trying to change, People often freak out. They can't understand what's happening. They don't know what to do. But remarkably quickly, just like a cell, an organization settles into a new, steady state. The only question is whether the new state is better than the old one. Is the cell cancerous or healthy? How, I wondered, can we figure out some simple rules that will guide teams to settle into a more productive, happier, supportive, fun, and ecstatic state? I spent the next 15 years trying to figure that out. During the Reagan administration, the government radically cut grants for scientific research, including my National Cancer Center's research grant, where I was principal investigator of data collection and analysis for Colorado Regional Cancer Center clinical trials and epidemiology studies. As I was figuring out what to do, a company called Mid-Continent Computer Services contacted me because they heard I was the leading expert in the area of their newest technology. Mid-Continent was in the business of servicing 150 banks across North America. Their hottest new product was what they called an automatic teller machine network. This was in 1983, when getting cash usually meant standing in line at a bank or pulling up to a bank's drive-through window in your car. You'd write a check out to cash in the amount you wanted and hand it to the teller. ATMs were going to solve this hassle. But back then, Mid-Continent was having problems getting its networks to talk to one another. They needed someone who'd been thinking about systems to fix this, and they made me a lucrative offer to be a vice president of advanced systems. Their network computers were the same machines I'd spent years running my doctoral programs on, so it was a good fit. Or so I thought. Nothing is ever easy, is it? When I walked into the company, I came upon a division doing waterfall method projects. There were hundreds of computer programmers who sat at their desks all day ostensibly working, but they couldn't deliver anything on time or on budget. For the automated teller machines, costs were 30% higher than revenue. The inefficiencies were mind-boggling. I spent some time early on trying to figure out how things worked. You can imagine how upper management treated my guys. There was a lot of screaming and micromanaging and passive-aggressive behavior and demands for harder work and overtime. But no matter how much management pressed, the projects were still chronically late, still over budget, and not delivering what they were supposed to. I decided the best option was for us to change everything. The operation was too broken to fix piecemeal. So I decided to make a company within a company. I asked our CEO, Ron Harris, to let me form a separate organization with everyone who was involved in the ATM networks. We'd have our own sales team, our own marketing team, and our own finance people. Ron was a brilliant and creative CEO who trusted my work. Perhaps under someone else, this would never have happened. After hearing my idea, he told me, "Sutherland, if you want that kind of headache, take it." I did. I went to the developers and managers and told them, "The first thing we need to do is to stop doing stuff that is killing us. It's like that old joke about banging your head against a brick wall just so it feels good when you stop. We've got to figure out a better way of working," I told them, "and we have to start immediately." So we ran the entire small company as one team split up into sub-teams. Bonuses weren't based on individual performance. They were based on total company performance. We came up with tools that found their way into Scrum 10 years later. For example, the concept of a product owner, a product backlog, and weekly sprints, which I'll get into more deeply later, and which are laid out in the appendix. In 6 months, we were the most profitable division in the company. Revenue was 30% higher than expenses. Our non-stop tandem systems were the first online transaction computers the banks trusted enough to use. We deployed them all over North America. Nowadays, just about anywhere you go in the country, you can find an ATM machine. And all those machines know exactly how much money you have. My team had a lot to do with that. And yes, you're welcome. Learning to think like a robot. After my first career in the military and my second in academia, I found myself something of an outsider in business. But that outsider's perspective was one of my most valuable assets. From day one, it was a mystery to me why people insist on working in ways they know are inefficient and wasteful and that are dehumanizing and depressing. I guess they figure that's the way everyone does it, so it must be the best way. I really enjoyed my time at Mid-Continent, but I was eager to test my skills on new challenges. For the next 2 decades, I ended up working for companies large and small as VP of Engineering or Chief Technology Officer. At each, I tried to get teams to work together in more efficient ways. At one of those companies, I found myself in a building in Cambridge, Massachusetts, just a few blocks from MIT. A few PhDs and professors had just started a new company building robots, and they'd run out of room in their lab at MIT. They ended up subletting some office space from my company. A few weeks after they moved in, the most unexpected thing happened. A six-legged robot the size of a cat ran into my office and began chasing me around my desk. The roboticists came in and nervously apologized for their machine. But every few days, it would happen again. One of the robots would escape their lab and start running around the building. I'd hear the mechanical clacking of legs scurrying down the hallways. On Friday afternoons, I always served wine and beer at the office so that everyone could unwind and socialize after a hard week. I'd invite the roboticists down the hall to these events, and one Friday afternoon, Rodney Brooks showed up. Brooks, a professor of artificial intelligence at MIT, was one of the founders of the robot company. I asked him how the roving robots worked. "For decades, we've tried to make a really smart thinking machine," he told me. "We spent billions of dollars, many, many years of work, building the biggest computers we could with the biggest databases, but all we got was a computer that can beat people at chess." His robots, he explained, took a completely different approach. Rather than try to build something with a single central brain, they built a robot in which each of the six legs had its own brain. A processor in the spine had a few simple rules. Move forward, go back, don't bump into other legs. The neural network chip in the head of the robot knew these rules and acted as referee for all the parts. It told the legs what it was seeing through its camera when it hit an obstacle, that kind of thing. "What's interesting," Brooks said, "is that each time you turn on the robot, it learns to walk for the first time. There is no database of where everything is in the room. Instead, the world is its database. It figures out everything for the first time each time it is switched on. It bumps into things and figures things out based on the actual surroundings, which means it can adapt to any environment. Let me show you," he said as he took me over to their lab. He popped a blank neural chip into one of the insectoid robots, and I watched it wobble to life. Hesitantly at first, it stumbled around the room like a fawn, picking itself up on its legs for the first time. With each step, it became more and more assured. The legs quickly learned to collaborate and work together. Within a few minutes, the robot was racing around the room. Nothing was stored or programmed about how to walk. Instead, a few simple rules kept these components working together. These legs didn't think, they just did. I was blown away by the ingenuity and simplicity of the system. Here was something that was doing exactly what I was trained to do flying in Vietnam. Observe, orient, decide, and act. It was taking in its environment and behaving decisively based on the data from that environment. "What would happen," I asked Brooks, "if we could come up with a simple instruction set for teams of people to work together just like those legs? They would self-organize and self-optimize just like that robot." "I don't know," he replied. "Why don't you try it and let me know how it works out?" Don't go chasing waterfalls. More and more I realized, if I could create a system that, like that robot, could coordinate independent thinkers with constant feedback about their environment, much higher levels of performance would be achieved. By streamlining the flow of information among legs of a group, we could achieve efficiencies that had never been reached before. My conversation with Rodney Brooks took place more than 2 decades ago. For many years, he was the head of robotics and artificial intelligence at MIT, and that spidery robot I met, dubbed Genghis Khan, now sits in the Smithsonian as a museum piece. By now, you're probably familiar with one of Brooks' companies, iRobot, which makes the Roomba vacuum cleaner and uses the same adaptive intelligence to clean your floors that Genghis Khan used to chase me around my office. His latest innovation at Rethink Robotics, the Baxter robot, can work collaboratively with humans in a common workspace. I was inspired by Brooks' work, and in 1993, I took those ideas with me to a company called ESEL, where I was hired as VP of Object Technology. The executives at ESEL wanted my team to develop a completely new product line in 6 months that would be aimed at some of their biggest customers, such as the Ford Motor Company, which used